is the third case this morning on this panel's oral argument docket, Susan and Jack Sadler versus Pacific Care of Nevada, case number 62111. Mr. Marquis, you ready to go?
I am. Thank you.
All right. Please proceed.
May it please the Senate of the Court, Craig Marquis on behalf of the appellants, along with my co-counsel, George West.
Good morning, Mr. West.
With the court's indulgence, I'd like to reserve 4 hours for a rebuttal argument. All right.
You don't mind
best of it.
You don't mind if the court clerk and the panel has already left by then, do you?
I'm sure we might get there in about 2 minutes. Yes, I'll do my best.
All right, go right ahead, sir.
Thank you. Essentially, this court has before it a novel issue that was left open from a prior case, Badillo versus American Brands. That is the recognition of medical monitoring as a remedy in the state of Nevada, as compared to what this court in Badillo said was inappropriate, recognizing it as a separate cause of action. What was not addressed by this honorable court in Badillo was the appropriate claim or action to which the remedy might properly be attached. While the court did not recognize it as a cause of action, it did indicate that it would be appropriate as a remedy in the appropriate circumstance. The case before this court is exactly that quintessential example of a case tied to negligence. In this particular case, that issue has been fully briefed before the court as to the appropriateness of tying it to negligence. And in that regard, what the appellants are essentially asking this court to do is to recognize existing Nevada precedent and enforce the application of medical monitoring as a remedy tied to a negligence action based upon this court's prior history of when there is no controlling precedent, to essentially look to the restatement and look to our sister state of California for guidance. What the respondent or appellee is requesting in this case is essentially to circumvent Nevada law on that process and to adopt a more rigid standard, one which requires the imposition of physical harm, for which no case in the state of Nevada has ever required that, let alone any case addressing the issue of medical monitoring, of which the Badillo case is the only state law case in that regard. When we look at the circumstances of the jurisdictional issue of where we are here before this court, the lower court granted the HMO Pacific Care's motion for judgment on the pleadings pursuant to Rule 12C. And it did so based on several erroneous beliefs and positions which we've set forth in the briefing. The first of which is the court's determination of not only an unreasonable but an impractical standard for purposes of dismissing the case on the grounds that the plaintiffs did not allege in the court's mind that it was an actual exposure to contaminated blood. Now, what essentially the court in the 12C motion is required to do, as your honors are well aware, is to accept the allegations of the complaint as being true. With regard to the complaint at issue here, the complaint sets forth two claims or causes of action, one for negligence generally, one for negligence per se, based upon the existence of a statutory scheme governing the HMOs and the requirements for them to establish mandated quality assurance, quality control programs under 695C-400 at SEC. Among those particular requirements are specifically to develop a program, to implement a committee, which is to go out at least annually to each of their providers to establish the appropriate guidelines of quality assurance and quality control programs to prevent against unsafe or improper medical procedures.
Counsel, to that end, I'm a little concerned because there's some case law that this court has created as to that particular issue, which is nowhere in what is before this court in terms of the final outcome. You know, I'm a little bothered by that, how it's not intertwined. Should I be concerned, or should I only look at what's here and the argument? Because we have the healthcare provider, not the endoscopy center, who's at issue here.
That is correct, Justice Douglas, and allow me to address that issue directly. Because the state regulation, which has the force and effect of law based upon NRS 439-200, indicates that the Department of Health can make regulations which have the force and effect of law, which in this particular case, the 695C 400 at sex series was expressly adopted and became law in the state of Nevada as of November 1st of 1995. That issue of the HMO's applications is what is directly relevant here. This is not a medical malpractice case where we're pursuing a claim against the medical providers at the endoscopy centers that created the worst hepatitis outbreak in this nation's history. This case is directly related to the HMOs, in this particular case, Pacific Care, that failed to honor that statutory obligation to create the appropriate quality assurance, quality control program to ensure that those particular aseptic techniques were implemented so that the outbreak that occurred would never have occurred. Had they done what they were required to do statutorily, this outbreak would have never occurred. Instead of honoring that statutory obligation and investing the funds that they needed to invest in order to develop that program, they elected to look the other way. And that's the conduct that's essentially at the heart of this. And when we go to the principles of tort law and what is the appropriate standard to recognize, it's important to note that this state has a long history in recognizing what a tort is, the invasion of private, of the legally protected interest of another. The restatement,
Mr. McKee, before you move into that argument, though, to follow up on Justice Douglas's question, there was a motion apparently in this case that raised ERISA and that preemption. The court deferred on that. It wasn't renewed. The motion then addressed this question. I think the question for the panel that the panel has is whether the legal issue raised in this appeal is potentially moot because of prior actions by this court recognizing preemption in these cases. I know that that issue hasn't been briefed here, but it is a concern about whether this is a viable controversy that the court should be undertaking.
Justice Hardesty, I certainly expand upon my answer and follow-up as well for Justice Douglas. This case is essentially a companion case. There is another case entitled Bean versus Health Plan of Nevada. That also is a case of which I'm representing the plaintiffs and putative class members in. And I can represent to the court that there's actually federal precedent that was set by Chief Justice Hunt, who was the presiding judge over that case when the defendants, the Health Plan of Nevada entities, which are all United Healthcare, which is the parent of Pacific Care, filed a motion to dismiss on the basis of ERISA. What I can represent to this court based upon the published opinion is that this case is not, nor is that companion case, exempted by ERISA. It is a properly viable claim before the state court because what the federal district court determined as a matter of federal law is that the issue of ensuring that quality assurance, quality control programs are properly implemented and enforced is a state police power belonging to the states, not to the federal government under an ERISA preemption issue. So this case is properly before this court as well as the state court going forward on that basis that there is no ERISA preemption. And this is not similar to the arbitration issue that I believe the court addressed previously in that context of whether or not arbitration requirements were met here. Were appropriate.
Well, the panel's raised this in oral argument. Of course, we'll ask Mr. Posenberg to comment, but it might be more appropriate for the parties to offer supplemental briefing on the point after oral argument. Because I think the issue that you're raising is an important one, but it is a concern about reaching it when there might very well be some procedural basis for the case not going forward or for going forward.
Certainly, Justice Hardesty, we would welcome the opportunity should the panel decide that it would request that. We will certainly provide it and provide a copy of Justice Hunt's decision as well along to support that particular argument.
Okay. Sorry for interrupting you. Taking you on a side desk.
Completely appropriate to do so. And going back then to the issue of recognized tort law, Nevada has long followed the restatement with respect to an invasion of any legally protected interest of another. And the restatement contrasts that definition from harm generally and physical harm, which is what the respondents are asking this court to implement and to require, which is clearly more rigid and restrictive in that context. There is no Nevada case that has required physical injury or harm to be required. In fact, when we look at the exposure that's at issue here, it's not exposure to actual contaminated blood. There's no physical way that a plaintiff could represent in a complaint absent doing testing on everyone who walked through that door to determine whether or not they were in fact tested, or tested positive essentially for one of the blood-borne diseases at issue, whether that's HIV, hepatitis B, C, or another. And that's essentially the inappropriate standard that the defendants are requesting and what the lower court unfortunately ruled. They're putting the cart before the horse. They want you to establish that you in fact were exposed to contaminated blood and that you in fact are testing positive or have tested positive, when the very purpose of this particular class is to provide that mechanism for the class members to obtain that testing to either confirm or dispel whether or not they are in fact infected. And that is the thrust of essentially what it is that we're asking for. The court in Badillo recognized that a toxic exposure that is discreet and more ascertainable would be less problematic in the case of a secondhand smoke. We have a very discreet issue here. We have a very discreet exposure. The pathways are common to all members of the class. The diagnostic testing that is being required and is medically necessary is specific. The fact that the exposure was discreet based upon the avenue through the improper reusing of syringes and vials, as well as the nature by which the underlying claim arose from the failure of the HMO provider Pacific Care to maintain a quality assurance and quality control program. When this court looks to the appropriate standard, in addition to the restatement recognizing the appropriateness of the claim, the second basis is to look to our sister state, California. And there are two discrete cases which have already come down, that being the Miranda versus Shell Oil opinion, as well as the Potter versus Firestone Tire and Rubber Co. case. Both of those cases expressly recognized as the plaintiff's advance in the underlying action and appellant's advance here, is that claims should be allowed to proceed in the absence of physical injury, because the nature is that the medical examination is in itself is compensable without any other proof of injury. In the Miranda case, it was adopting a specific California statute, California Civil Code 333, which defines this particular scenario as a detriment, allowing the recovery in the absence of any physical injury. And as Mr. Paulsenberg previously argued before this court in the Badillo case on behalf of the appellants Badillo, recognizing the appropriateness of that standard to allow for the recovery of medical monitoring promotes the social fairness as well as elemental justice, because it fosters access to early medical testing. It mitigates the cost of future illnesses, prevents the inequitable allocation associated with medical costs, and it will deter future exposure to hazardous substances, making companies like Pacific Care more socially responsible in what they do and how they comply with state statutes. The import of where we are essentially is we need to establish that the ability to complete discovery in order to present the court with the expert record that is necessary for the court ultimately to adopt that standard, as we've set forth in Miranda and Potter in our briefs. It's appropriate for the court to recognize the existence of medical monitoring as a remedy under a negligence cause of action, which we're asking the court to do. But in order to give the lower courts guidance in implementing that going forward, it's also important that this court adopt the standard. And certainly what we would request is that the court adopt that Miranda and Potter standard to give the lower courts guidance as to implementing this particular reasoning, what they need to evaluate, and that is an expert factual-driven scenario. Now, I'll reserve the balance of my time for purposes of the rebuttal argument, but I do want to at least briefly for a moment discuss the arguments of the two cases that were advanced by the appellants, or by the appellees. the Boulder City versus Miles decision, as well as the Zerkes versus Robinson. Neither one of those cases, contrary to what the respondents have advanced, set any different standard of physical injury. Both of those cases merely set forth the general rule, which is that you have to have an injury, not physical injury. And when we look at the public policy behind this case and the issues that have been presented, to require a plaintiff to go forward and incur the medical costs for necessary and indicated testing that would not have been required but for the negligence of the defendant, not only is that unjust and inequitable, it's not good policy for the state, and it turns the law towards on its head to not provide compensation to victims from the tortious conduct of tortfeasors. So with that, Justices, if you have any questions now, I'll happily address them. If not, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you, Mr. McKee. You're out of time, but we'll add 2.5 minutes for your rebuttal period.
Thank you, Justice.
And Mr. Polzenberg will have 2.5 minutes added to his time.
Thank you, Justice Hardesty.
Thank you. Good morning, Justice Hardesty. May it please the Court. In our time today, let me see if I can address 4 points. Let me address Justice Douglas's jurisdictional issue. Let me talk about exposure, because I think counsel is right. That's the basis of Judge Scan's decision. Let me third go into why this case doesn't present this issue at all, and then maybe a little bit fourth into injury. This court is more protective of its jurisdiction than the litigants are. In our answering brief, we pointed out that we had raised the federal ERISA preemption issue and that we had reserved it, and if you rule that way, we'll go back down and address that. Perhaps the more appropriate way under Cervantes is to address it if the court wants to in supplemental briefing. But yeah, I do think that the issue exists. And it may be an issue, especially since I don't think this case properly presents the issue we are addressing today, it may be a more proper way to handle the case to have supplemental briefing on that. Second issue, exposure. Judge Scan decided this on exposure. There's no doubt about that. She says that in her decision in the record at page 634. She goes into how this is just a risk of exposure to disease case and that the law does not recognize medical monitor in those contexts. And that's absolutely true. In their complaint, paragraph 1, they say that this is a possible exposure. Paragraph 36, a potential exposure. Paragraph 47, they talk about that it's exposure and or the risk of disease. But the exposure here is not enough. Now, they're very candid, and I commend them for that. And they say that there's no way that they could represent an actual exposure to contaminated blood. And without that, they don't really have a cause of action. If you look, now, we talk about...
Excuse me if I may interrupt. Paragraph 59 of the class action complaint alleges, and Judge Scan quotes it, that they have been exposed to or placed at risk by contracting HIV, etc. Paragraph 22, they offer exposure to the blood or other patients by using unsterile syringes. While she concludes the complaint does not allege actual infection, it does indicate that the complaint, to me at least, that the complaint alleges exposure to the infection. That would be the first element under Potter, at least for purposes of this motion. Isn't that sufficient?
Well, first of all, they talk about exposure and or risk. And when they're talking about exposure, they're using exposure in two sentences throughout the briefing. One is actual medical exposure, which means that you have contact with, and I can't think of a better word than contact, but they're also using it in the insurance risk concept, where exposure is simply being left open to it. It's a risk concept. Mm-hmm. And here they don't have any they don't allege actual exposure. They allege possible exposure, potential exposure, and exposure and or risk. And Judge Scan cites the Cook case, the District of Colorado case, where they say that the when you live near the nuclear power plant and you think that you may, because you live near it, you may have radioactivity. Well, just the idea that you may be at risk is not enough to state a cause of action. Citing the supplemental authorities, the Exxon Mobil versus Ford case, where the court actually went to the point, there we have leaking gasoline, it permeates the ground, it hits the water wells of the local residents. And in those situations, you test the wells. And some of the plaintiffs in that case, their well water tested below any dangerous levels. Now, these are very low dangerous levels. They're 20 points, parts per billion. And the court said, well, you don't have any exposure to toxic levels of the chemical. You don't have exposure. And you talk about the first element. The first element, Your Honor, of Potter isn't exposure. It's significant exposure. And the second element is that it will significantly increase the risk of disease. The cases that we've cited in our supplemental authorities, we do the supplemental authorities in two groups, one saying here are the cases that do say that you have to have actual physical injury, and here are the other cases who have decided that there's a substitute for actual physical injury, but you need a significant exposure, not a risk, a significant exposure. And here I think that's where Judge Scan was correct. And you know, we talk about this being 12C and judgment on the pleadings. In one sense, unfortunately for me, it is, because they made these allegations about we have been negligent and we failed to comply with certain quality assurance regulations. Now, in this appeal, I'm stuck with those allegations. Although one floor down, today, for weeks now, we've been trying a Pacific Care case where it actually has been shown all the quality assurance programs that Pacific Care has and how we have complied with these regulations. I understand that's not in front of you. But where we're not a 12C case, where we have to look at the bold allegations of exposure, is when we're talking about the exposure. Plaintiffs themselves have set out the Southern Nevada Health District report at length, and it talks about, and this converts, I mean, we have proof beyond the pleadings here. And that proof in the executive summary on page 293, it talks about possible exposure for the individual patients here. It talks about could have introduced the blood. There is not enough here in individual cases to say that there was an exposure. If you go further in and you look at the letter that was sent to these class members, it just says that this testing is a precaution to take appropriate steps to protect your health. This is not a situation where there has been an exposure. Let me explain to you why. Because this is laid out with graphs on page 366 and 367 of the record. And what happened here is there were a number of certified registered nurse anesthetists, CRNAs. And what would happen is that one or two of them would take the vial of propofol, take a clean syringe, draw propofol into the syringe, and inject a patient. Now, if that was not enough, CRNA1 would take off the needle, put on a clean needle, and use the dirty syringe in the vial. Throw away that syringe, take another syringe with another patient, but still use the same vial. Now, there's a chance under those circumstances that when you went to the patient and took blood and went back to the vial, this is double dipping and this is double dosing, there's a chance that it could be infected. And that's a chance. But the CRNA 2 and CRNA 3 said they would throw away the syringe and the vial. So this is not a situation where every patient of these endoscopy clinics was going to be exposed to contaminated blood, was going to be exposed to another patient's blood at all. And even the ones who were simply, if there was exposure to other blood, it wasn't contaminated blood. So you don't have the requisite element, the first requisite element of Potter, which is to prove a significant exposure to the toxic contamination. And without that, they just don't make out a claim. Which is why I really think that this case doesn't even present the Badillo issue. The Badillo, that they argue that it presents Badillo because it is a discrete exposure. Well, this exposure is far from discrete. While I think they're trying to say it's not the abstract exposure, there's an actual exposure in Badillo to secondhand smoke. It wasn't clear what the quality or quantity of it was and what causative role it would have. And this court has addressed exposure issues several times in the last few years, including in Holcomb, where the court would look at the amount of the exposure and whether there was a sufficiency there. I argue that recently in the case the court hasn't decided yet. But here, it's just speculation whether there was exposure at all. We don't have the discrete exposure. Now, counsel is nice enough to point out that I argued the deal for the plaintiffs, and I did. And this court, many of you were on the court at the time, was pretty harsh about the way I had argued the case, because I wouldn't tie the remedy to a cause of action. And I instead argued that it had to be a separate cause of action. And this court rejected the idea that there is a separate cause of action for medical monitoring. So then you have to tie it into some existing cause of action. Plaintiffs argue that they have that here because they've stated a negligence case. But the plaintiffs in Badillo had a negligence case, and a strict liability case, and a fraud case, and a misrepresentation case. Just stating a claim doesn't show how it works. If they come in here and they're going to argue that the mere fact that they have a negligence claim is enough, then the plaintiffs in Badillo would have won. But the plaintiffs in Badillo didn't show how the cause of action without any actual physical injury could be made. And the court refused to address that issue because the record was so unclear. Here the record is not unfulfilled. Not in a 56F sense. We have what actually happened. We have the fact that it's only a possible exposure or a potential exposure, or in the words of the health district, could have. So here we have a record that shows that this isn't the case to decide what the law is for medical monitoring. This may raise the same question as Badillo, but it doesn't go any further in answering it than the Badillo case did. Finally, let me go to injury. And I think this is the bridge that I'm talking about between this case doesn't make out a claim because there is no exposure, and the fact that the law always does, in negligence, require an actual physical injury. And after the briefing, the New York court came down and said, no, there was a wave of cases where we thought we could change existing causes of action to make out medical monitoring claims. But no, we're going to require actual physical injury if you're going to have a negligence claim. And that's what we're talking about, duty, breach, causation, and damages. It's not enough to come in here and say, well, the injury here is the injury to your protected right not to have testing. Judge Hunt and Judge Earle in the district court held that there isn't a cause of action for the need to be tested. And that's just like the Ford case that I talked about from Maryland, where they had to test their wells to see whether there was toxic levels of exposure. You don't have a cause of action for your well being tested. This isn't an asbestosis case. This isn't a cancer case. This isn't a benzene case. Those kinds of injuries take decades to develop. So in those circumstances, you do actually, at least you can make out the third element, where progressive and periodic testing would be necessary. All that's necessary, and the record's clear here because we have it from the health district, all that's necessary here is to check and see, just get a test to see if you have hepatitis C or B or HIV. Now, the fact that you went and got the test doesn't give you a cause of action. These plaintiffs, by virtue of their pleadings, weren't even in that situation. They're coming in now and saying, we want prospective testing. And this simply is not the case for that. And for all these circumstances, this is not the case that presents the question. There may be a case in the future. There may be a case in the future where somebody comes in and says, look at these fumes that took place. Let's take the Hilton fire case. And part of the reason why I set out the Albright case and the Ford case, both ExxonMobil cases from Maryland, is because those cases talk about a number of causes of action, the fear of cancer, medical monitoring. And while those courts had allowed it, they set out very rigid thresholds for being able to make them. This case comes so far from meeting those thresholds that I don't even have to argue you need a physical injury. They don't meet the Potter standard as an excuse for not having a physical injury. So I don't think the case is presented here at all. So I think the court's left with two possibilities here. It could either say, this case doesn't present this issue. We're not going to address whether there is a cause of action under unusual circumstances for medical monitoring. And let me correct myself, because the court said there isn't a cause of action in Badillo. We're not going to address whether we're going to modify the elements of negligence to allow it, because this case doesn't present it, and we're going to affirm. Or the court could order supplemental briefing on the preemption issue. But I think here, probably the easier course of action is simply to say that the case isn't presented.
All right. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Postlebrook.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Markey.
Mr. Pulsenberg started with his argument of the anesthesia with the propofol vial and the syringe. And the difficulty with that particular argument that the respondents are advancing is that there's no physical way that any particular plaintiff would ever know where they were in the stack of procedures that day, whether they were the first person, or the second person, or the 10th person in a particular procedure room. That is the very reason why the CDC didn't say in its report on the worst hepatitis outbreak in the country, go get tested only if you've been exposed to actually contaminated blood. They sent out a directive that all 63,000 people that they had identified should be tested because of that very reason. So when we're speaking about exposure, let's focus on what the real exposure is. It's not the issue with respect to the contaminated blood, because as we know, that's a red herring argument so that the defendant in this particular case can avoid responsibility for their tortious conduct, creating this hazard that these individuals are now facing as to whether they are or not actually positive for one of these bloodborne diseases. What the CDC and the experts who were involved in that investigation, along with the Southern Nevada Health District, unequivocally confirmed is that the exposure was to the abhorrent medical practices of the unsafe health procedures that were fostered and allowed to occur as a result of Pacific Care and the other HMO's failure to perform.
Well, I think Potter requires more exposure than that. Maybe you're not at that stage in this case given the nature of the 12C motion, but ultimately if the court were to conclude that you get to at least make that showing, the fact that I was a patient in the endoscopy center isn't enough under Potter or even with the California's approach.
And Justice Hartsley, I would concur in that regard. The relevant standard and that first element under Potter isn't the significant exposure. It's an element of significance and the nature of the exposure that goes to the heart of that particular issue.
I've characterized it as the extent of the plaintiff's exposure, but I think that it does require a heightened level and that exposure means, you know, directly to the blood-borne disease, not to, I was just in the building.
Understand, and each and every member, as the class has been defined, Justice Hardesty, expressly provides for the group of individuals who received the injection of anesthesia or propofol for purposes of one of the procedures, in this case either a colonoscopy or an endoscopy. The injection of the anesthesia and the relationship of the vial is directly at issue and been set forth in the complaint for purposes of that standard. And obviously, additional discovery will highlight that particular issue going forward. The other issue that I wanted to point out very briefly is the supplemental authorities that Mr. Pulsenberg had referenced. Obviously, those was filed 2 days ago. I was out of town when it was filed. I got back yesterday, looked at that, and I noted that with the exception of two or three cases that were recent, or at least recent in time after the answer and brief was filed, the vast majority of every case that was referenced is a case that was in existence at the time that the answer and brief was filed. So it's inappropriate for a supplementation other than things that are new. But importantly, not one of the supplemental authorities that was referenced by the respondents addressed the issues of the Miranda case or the Potter case are anything other than still valid and viable law. And since this state has no controlling law on issue, looking to the restatement and looking to California law, that would be the appropriate basis for the law of what this court should look to adopt and recognize going forward, as opposed to a non-presidential decision from New York or one of the other jurisdictions that were cited, as that is more closely to home as set forth in Badillo. The sister states, Nevada, Arizona, Utah, California, do not require the existence of a physical injury in order to substantiate a claim going forward, recognizing the appropriateness of medical monitoring. This is a discrete issue. We've set forth in our briefing the contact, the nature of how this happened, the fact that this exposure was a result of the HMO's failure to implement that plan is directly at heart of what we're addressing. And with respect to the claims going forward, the court has a couple of options. As Mr. Pulsenberg indicated, what we are requesting that the court do is reverse and remand, adopt that California line of reasoning, as well as the reinforcement of the existing law of the restatement, allow this case to go forward with the directive of the standard that ultimately will be enforced by the Miranda Potter line of reasoning, to give the courts down below that guidance to know what those factors are and what expert information is going to be required to determine the appropriateness of that standard for medical monitoring going forward. And with that, certainly we'll look to the justices for direction as to the supplemental briefing of the ERISA issue. But I thank you very much for your time this afternoon.
Okay, Mr. Marquis, Mr. Pulsenberg, thank you very much for outstanding arguments and briefing in the case. The matter will stand submitted. Thank you.